Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us this morning. The United States government now has greater authority to eavesdrop without warrants on American citizens' telephone calls and emails after President Bush signed new surveillance legislation into law on Sunday. Authored largely by the White House, the new law, officials say, provides a legal framework for warrantless monitoring that was already being conducted by the National Security Agency outside of the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, otherwise known as FISA. Many Democrats and civil rights activists argue that this new law erodes fundamental American liberties and privacy rights. Supporters contend that it's vital to fend off potential terrorist attacks. We're going to talk about this with Jeffrey Stone, who's the Harry Calvin Jr. Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. He's been a member of the law faculty there since 1973, teaches primarily in the areas of constitutional law and evidence, and writes principally in the field of constitutional law. His most recent books are Top Secret, When Our Government Keeps Us in the Dark, and War and Liberty, an American Dilemma. And it's a pleasure to have him on the telephone with us. Good morning, Mr. Stone.
Good morning. Delighted to be here.
Thank you so much. And if people have feelings one way or another or questions about this legislation, they're encouraged to join in. Our number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's a toll-free number at 800-642-1234. I believe you're one of the people who feel that this law is either overprotective or in some form is wrong.
Yes, I think it's misguided, and I think it was enacted without adequate debate and deliberation, authorizing certain types of intrusions on privacy that have not been adequately justified and have not been set up in a setting in which there is sufficient accountability.
The basic legal question involved is not a new one. It goes back at least to 1978.
Right. The framework in which the question arises is fairly complex, and it may be useful just to briefly set that framework.
Certainly.
The Fourth Amendment generally provides that the government may not engage in wiretapping or the interception of private email correspondence without the government first demonstrating probable cause to believe that unlawful conduct is afoot and obtaining a search warrant from a judge. In 1972, President Nixon sought authority to allow the president on his own initiative, without probable cause and without a warrant, to engage in that type of surveillance, at least in cases involving national security.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court of the United States unanimously rejected that and said that the fact that a surveillance is involved for national security purposes does not change in any way the requirements of the Fourth Amendment. After that, Congress enacted the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act for the purpose of striking a balance between the needs of national security and the interest of individual privacy. And in that statute, Congress created a separate court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which would have certain provisions enabling it to act in a high degree of secrecy, but it retained the requirements of probable cause and a warrant, finding that there was not any necessity, even in foreign intelligence, to eliminate those basic Fourth Amendment protections. And that's the way the law stood until after 9/11, when President Bush secretly authorized the National Security Agency to engage in intercepts of telephone communications and email exchanges between individuals in the United States and individuals outside the United States, when the investigation was directed towards individuals who had some connection to terrorism. And this program existed secretly for a while when it was finally revealed by the New York Times. After it was revealed, critics, including myself, argued that the program violated both the Fourth Amendment and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is a criminal statute, makes it a crime for any person to engage in electronic surveillance in violation of the law. And since this procedure put in place by the president for the National Security Agency did not involve either a warrant or probable cause, it clearly was inconsistent with FISA. The president and his defenders argued that this was not a violation of the Fourth Amendment, a violation of FISA. Specifically, the president argued that when Congress authorized the use of military force in Iraq, it implicitly amended FISA, giving him much broader authority to engage in this sort of surveillance. And he argued that FISA was unconstitutional insofar as it attempted to limit the power of the president as commander-in-chief. Both of those arguments were rejected in federal court and have been rejected by the vast weight of authority of constitutional experts. And both, I think, are, in fact, unpersuasive. Finally, the president, in January of this year, agreed to have the NSA program overseen by the FISA court. Although it was not clear to anyone, at least anyone outside the administration, what exactly overseen meant. In any event, now, finally, the president goes to Congress and sought legislation that would authorize the Attorney General or the Director of National Intelligence to approve electronic surveillance of email exchanges and telephone conversations that are international, but that involve, on one end, an American on American soil speaking with someone somewhere else in the world, whenever the surveillance is directed at a person outside the United States. So the theory was that as long as the target of the investigation is a person outside the United States, that there is no need for a warrant, no need for probable cause. So in effect, what the administration did is to push through Congress legislation that now does, at least for 6 months, authorize most of the types of investigations that previously had not been authorized by FISA.
We're talking with Professor Jeffrey Stone of the University of Chicago Law School about the warrantless wiretaps expanded. And if you'd like to join in, the number in Madison is 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234. This the law, as signed on Sunday, requires telecommunications companies to participate and to cooperate with requests for information to a greater degree than ever before possible.
Right. Previously, it was taken to be the case that telecommunications companies like you and I had a right not to turn over information to the government unless the government had lawful authorization to do so. And what this law does now is to give the government the legal authority to demand that telecom companies disclose that information and make their facilities available to the government, which facilitates greatly the capacity of the government to engage in electronic interception of Americans' communications.
The president had said that the original surveillance program was restricted to phone calls and emails involving a suspected terrorist. Does the new law have any such limit?
Interestingly, it does not appear to. In some ways, this appears to be even broader than what the president initially described. It does presumably cover only investigations for purposes of foreign intelligence, which is some limitation. But it doesn't actually say that there needs to be any reasonable grounds to believe that the individual on the other end of the line, that is, the individual overseas, is reasonably suspected to be a terrorist. So in that sense, the legislation may actually give the president more than the original program. Although, of course, we don't know what the original program actually was, since it's never been publicly and specifically documented.
We're talking again with Professor Jeffrey Stone, Harry Calvin, Jr., Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. You were one of a number of professors who signed a letter that was sent to members of Congress, I believe, regarding the situation.
Well, the letter I signed was regarding the not this most recent situation, but the earlier question about the FISA legislation and whether hearings should be held.
Mm-hmm.
My view then, which remains my view, and apparently remains the president's view in light of his statements the other day, is that the program up until now was unlawful. It violated a federal criminal law, FISA. It was either known to violate that law or certainly should have been known to violate that law, since in my view and in the view of most constitutional and legal scholars, the law was actually quite clear, that it would be perfectly appropriate for Congress to investigate and even possible for there to be criminal prosecutions for the violation of the law. And what my reference to what the president did recently is he said that when Congress returns after the summer recess, he wants it to consider legislation that would provide immunity from prosecution for any individuals who participated in the secret NSA surveillance program, which I have to say is a new wrinkle in all of this, which I find quite stunning. What the president appears to want to do is to say that any public employee who complies with the orders of the president of the United States is automatically immune from criminal prosecution, which is essentially the argument that I was only following orders. In the American system, we do hold individuals accountable, at least in some circumstances, even when they are obeying orders. And the idea that there should be immunity for individuals who engage in that conduct as a blanket matter is really quite stunning.
We have calls coming in, and we'll get to those in just a moment. Let's look at a few of the points that were raised in the letters to members of Congress back in January, that Congress didn't implicitly authorize the NSA domestic spying program in the authorization for use of military force against Al-Qaeda, and in fact expressly prohibits this in FISA. Is that true?
Yes, but one of the Bush administration's arguments for the legality of the original program was that when Congress authorized the use of military force, that the authorization to use military force implicitly suggested that the president could engage in widespread surveillance, even of American citizens on American soil, without meeting the requirements of the Fourth Amendment and without meeting the requirements of the FISA statute. And that argument was completely unpersuasive, because the FISA statute itself makes very clear that even in the case of a declaration of war, that the president is allowed to avoid the requirements of FISA for a period of only 15 days, during which time, if he wants to amend FISA, he can do so. At least he can ask Congress to do so. In this instance, of course, the spy program went on for several years in secret, not 15 days, and the president did not seek an amendment of the statute during the period that the program was secret. So thus one was to argue that the authorization to use military force is somehow more powerful than a declaration of war, which is patently absurd. That argument that the authorization to use force implicitly authorized a what otherwise would be a violation of FISA clearly doesn't carry any weight.
So as it stands now with the signing of the law, if I'm on vacation in Italy and I call my mother-in-law to check on the well-being of my dog, that conversation is just as recorded and collected by the government as any other call going overseas.
Yes. Insofar as the government, again, there are limitations on this law. The government is not supposed to do this unless it is engaged in foreign intelligence surveillance. And that's some restriction, although we don't know what the meaning of it is.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones and take some calls as we talk with Professor Jeffrey Stone of the University of Chicago Law School. And Jim is first in La Crosse. Jim, what's on your mind today?
It's actually Joe, but good morning.
Yes, Joe.
The question I have is, first a comment. One, it strikes me really profoundly that we're burning down the village in order to save it. I mean, I'm really concerned about the state of our democracy and everything right now, because I don't think that this current legislative branch is upholding its responsibility. I'm not sure why they're so gutless and why they're so misinformed or unwilling to inform themselves of constitutional issues, but it clearly strikes me that they're abrogating their responsibility. So that leads to the question, which is, if, as it appears to be, it's clear that the president and others were in direct violation of federal statutes, of federal laws, before this new law was put in place, what's the remedy for that? I mean, I'm a big believer in impeaching the current administration, because I think it would open up and shed light on what's going on. I'm not really that appalled with the current administration ad hominem, but I just am really concerned for what this means going forward, that there's so much secrecy and there's so little attempt to really understand what's happening and to prosecute it effectively under the rule of law. I mean, our nation, what we're ostensibly fighting for is the values of our nation, and it seems like every day we're undermining those, and I don't understand.
Well, those are extremely apt points. First, I'd say that in wartime, there is always a stress placed on the ordinary expectations about individual liberties and the need of the government to protect the national security. This is a constant theme in American history. Second, I do agree that the Congress has not exercised the degree of independence and oversight that it is expected to exercise under the Constitution. In part, for the first 6 years of Mr. Bush's presidency, that was because the Congress was controlled by his own party, and it's unusual for the party that controls the legislative branch, if it's the same party as the president, to take him on in any serious way. But I think the decision to enact this recent legislation is especially distressing because it would not have been enacted without the support of at least some Democrats. And the real question then is why would Democrats, both because their partisan interests are different and because they do, I think, have a better appreciation of the individual liberty side of this issue, why would they waver? And I think the answer is simply that they are afraid of being tarred as soft on terrorism, that what was essentially said in the context of the debates over this legislation, which were done in a very hurried fashion, was that if there should be an attack on the United States in the next several months, it will be on your head. That is, the spokespersons for the administration essentially said that if you do not approve this legislation, we are going to point to you, and we're going to say that this could have been prevented but for the fact that you were obstinate and refused to give the president the powers that he needed in order to protect the nation. And at least some Democrats were unwilling to put themselves in that position. And what that illustrates is one of the dangers of wartime policymaking, is presidents have always been able to browbeat individuals who would otherwise have the sense to resist them with these kinds of threats. And it's frankly irresponsible for political figures on either side to use trumped-up fears in order to manipulate both the public, most importantly, and also the politicians. But it's also the responsibility of the politicians not to allow themselves to be intimidated. In this case, I think the Democrats who supported this, on the whole, acted quite badly and will come to regret this vote in the long run, certainly from the standpoint of the national interest. On the question of accountability and impeachment is an unusual act in American history. If it were known that the president had been advised unequivocally that a particular program was unlawful and could not constitutionally be defended, and he had nonetheless said, I'm going to do it, but let's keep it secret from the American people, and then got caught, I think impeachment would be a perfectly appropriate act on the part of the Congress. On the other hand, to the extent the president is advised by the people around him that a particular proposal is lawful, and he reasonably relies on that advice, if the advice turns out to be wrong or even if it turns out to be dishonest, I think it would be a stretch to impeach the president for that unless the action was truly reckless on his part. And that the accountable people should be those who gave the bad advice. In this instance, I rather suspect that it was the latter situation rather than the former. I'm quite confident that the president was advised at the time that he initiated the program that it was, in fact, lawful. And therefore, although I think the president shows bad judgment in not seeking a broader array of advice in the councils of government and not trying to hear differing points of view instead of essentially weeding out everyone who disagrees with what he wants to hear, which creates the situation where you get wrong advice. But I don't think the president knew that this was an illegal program at the time he initially approved it.
Joe, thank you very much for your call and for raising the points. We're going to continue in just a moment. I'm Jim Packard. Rhonda Fanning is our producer today. And you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, in for Kathleen Dunn, as we continue to talk about the NSA surveillance program with Harry Calvin Jr., Distinguished Service Professor of Law, Jeffrey Stone, from the University of Chicago Law School. He has written books like Top Secret, When Our Government Keeps Us in the Dark, and War and Liberty, An American Dilemma, working on a new book, Sexing the Constitution, and is currently chief editor of a 15-volume series, Inalienable Rights, published by the Oxford University Press between 2006 and 2010. We're happy to have him with us today, and we're going back to the phones to Jim in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Jim. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you. I would like to ask this question. What is the material difference between these activities, these surveillance activities, and the Nazi approach and that model that was, you know, the power which was given to Adolf Hitler by the bureaucracy? I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
All right, Jim.
Well, in terms of degree, there's a huge difference. I mean, this has been a very aggressive executive branch in attempting to arrogate to itself powers both under the guise of the commander-in-chief role and more generally as the executive branch. But I would not want to draw an analogy between President Bush and a true dictator. We have not essentially eliminated the legislative branch. If Congress had chosen not to adopt this legislation, which was within its authority, then presumably the president would have complied with it, although, of course, we don't know that for sure. So I think what we have is an overreaching executive, a president and an administration that believes to a moral certainty that it knows what is right, and that whether it be courts or the legislature, or even for that matter the American people, who may disagree, their view is we know what's right and we should be able to implement whatever we know is right. But at the same time, I think they do recognize that there are legal limits on what they can do, and if they cannot make at least a colorable claim in their own minds that the action is lawful, they will refrain from it. So I think that analogy is overstated. There's no question but that this administration has, in my opinion, as most wartime administrations, has at times gone further than it needed to go and further than it should have gone legally in pushing the limits of its authority. But it has not done so in a way that is different than the administrations of Franklin Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson or Abraham Lincoln or John Adams, not to put President Bush in that category, other than the fact that they, too, all overreached in asserting the authority of the presidency.
In number in Madison to call to get in on the program is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234 as we talk with Professor Jeffrey Stone of the University of Chicago Law School. Let's go to Ann next in Milwaukee. Ann, what can we do for you?
Hi. I haven't heard the whole conversation, so I don't know if this subject came up. But I have heard Jonathan Turley regularly on Keith Olbermann's MSNBC show, and he's also a constitutional lawyer, and he has mentioned that he believes the FISA court in itself is illegal because it's secret, and I wonder if you agree.
It's a good question. I think the answer is no, because it's limited only to dealing with issues of foreign intelligence. Foreign intelligence clearly involves a certain need for secrecy if it is to be carried out effectively. If we want to have a court involved in overseeing the activities of the executive branch in the realm of foreign intelligence, as a practical matter, the only way to do so is to guarantee that the court operates under certain limitations of secrecy. And so I think it's a compromise, but it's a necessary practical compromise. The two alternatives to having a court that operates in secret, and I'll explain what it means to say in secret in a moment, but the alternative to that would either mean you don't do foreign intelligence, which is impossible, or that you give the executive branch carte blanche to do what it wants to do without any judicial oversight, which would be also worse. Now, when we say it's a secret court, it's important to note it's not a criminal court, and it doesn't adjudicate disputes between individuals or between individuals and the government. So it's not as if someone could be dragged into the FISA court and criminally prosecuted. That would be unconstitutional. Its primary function is to approve or disapprove requests of the executive branch for authority to engage in surveillance. And to that extent, what it does is secret because we don't want people to know that they're being investigated when we're doing foreign intelligence surveillance, which is completely understandable. And that measure of secrecy in that specific context seems to have worked quite well and seems to be much better than either of the alternatives.
Anne, thank you very much for raising the point. And on to Dawn in Wauwatosa. Hi, Dawn.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm so angry about this legislation because I feel it not only curtails my Fourth Amendment rights, but it's onerous to the First Amendment. I feel that this new power will be used potentially in retaliation if I speak out about this administration. That is, my phone will be tapped, my emails will be scrutinized, and then this information can be used maliciously against me. So I feel the threat to my liberty rights, my First Amendment speech rights as well.
Well, surveillance of expression, including obviously emails and telephone conversations, implicates not only ordinary privacy rights, but also, as you suggest, speech rights, because obviously what you're doing when you use email or when you use the telephone is communicating, and people may well be deterred from being candid if they fear that the government is overhearing their communications. Now, what the government would say in response to this is you have nothing to fear, because even if we don't like you, even if we know you're a critic of the administration and we don't like you, this law only empowers us to investigate, A, for foreign intelligence purposes, and, B, when the investigation is directed at a person outside the United States. And since we have no legitimate foreign intelligence justification to investigate you, and since you're inside the United States, this law doesn't allow us to direct our investigation of you, at you. The only way we would ever come upon you in this surveillance scheme is inadvertently. If we were investigating someone in Berlin and you happened to be in communication with them, then we might incidentally wind up overhearing your phone call. So that would be their answer to this question. Now, there are two, I think, difficulties with that answer. First of all, your privacy is as important to you whether you're talking to someone in Berlin or whether you're talking to someone in New York. You don't really care from your standpoint whether your privacy is being invaded because the person on the other end of the phone is in Europe or Asia, or the person on the other end of the phone is in the East Coast or the West Coast. And since they clearly cannot even incidentally overhear your phone calls with a person in New York or Los Angeles without a warrant and probable cause, from your perspective, they shouldn't be able to do that if you're talking to somebody instead in Berlin or Tokyo. The other and more important point, though, has to do with one of the reasons for insisting on a warrant requirement is so that there is a clear and public record of every surveillance that the government undertakes. And that way the government is accountable for the surveillance it does. So it could not, as long as it complied with the law of getting warrants, get away with actually targeting you under this program impermissibly if it had to get a warrant in order to do wiretapping. Because it would have to go to a court, it would have to justify its wiretapping your phone, and it couldn't do so in this circumstance, and therefore it would not, in fact, undertake the wiretap. What this law does, by insulating the administration from the court process, from the warrant process, is essentially to allow them to eavesdrop over anything they want with no record being created and with no one being able to prove later that they were or were not the subject of in unlawful surveillance. So by taking the court out of the process, what the legislation does is to make it much easier for the government to abuse the power. And that's one of the reasons why the warrant process is so important, is that it creates a public record of every act, every surveillance that the government undertakes. Once you take the court out of it, that disappears.
And if by chance, somebody like Anne Dawn were targeted, the president is seeking legislation or the right to be able to absolve any of people in the administration from any prosecution for doing so. Is that right?
Well, actually, I'm not. What you just proposed is someone who is acting unlawfully, even within the confines of the program. And since the program does not authorize surveillance of someone in the United States as the target of surveillance, then it's not clear that the immunity the president's seeking would cover that. It certainly would cover anyone who was, well, more importantly, who before this weekend engaged in surveillance of an individual, say Ann or Dawn, incidentally to someone who was being wiretapped overseas. So the immunity that the president wants is backward-looking. From this day forward, the person doesn't need immunity because they're not violating the law under FISA, since FISA has now been amended. But what the president wants is immunity for everyone who acted subject to the executive branch program between the time it was initiated several years ago and this weekend, all of whom were acting at least arguably unlawfully. They may have the defense that I was following orders, but that's a question the court should decide, not the president.
Dawn, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Carol next in Willard. Carol, what's on your mind?
Well, my question is, if FISA court is secretive, and we have General Alberto Gonzalez, who from the last experience that he was questioned, I didn't feel he answered the questions, and the president saying that people don't, he doesn't want his staff and people to speak out. How do we ever get to the bottom of this?
Well, it's a very serious question.
Professor?
Yes.
We're losing your phone there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me change phones. Hold on one second.
Talking with Professor Jeffrey Stone.
Is this better?
Yes, that's much better.
One of the things the Bush administration has done since 9/11 is to use secrecy as a potent tool for denying the American people and the Congress the ability to hold them accountable, to second-guess them, which is part of their responsibility, in the decisions they've made involving the war on terrorism and other matters. That's quite disturbing, because for a self-governing society to work and for a system that's based upon the checks and balances to work, it's essential that there be a certain degree of transparency so people can evaluate the activities of their elected representatives. The Congress has begun in the last year to attempt to exercise some independent oversight function through the use of investigations, but the administration has been extremely aggressive about asserting claims of executive privilege, generally further than any predecessor has asserted those claims, and that creates itself a rather serious impasse between the Congress and the president, particularly because, here's another interesting wrinkle, ordinarily when the Congress wants information from a witness, whether it be a member of the executive branch or anyone else, it can hold them in contempt. But ordinarily, the Congress doesn't actually criminally prosecute people who are held in contempt. Ordinarily, it simply refers the matter over to the United States Attorney, who works for the Department of Justice, who prosecutes the person for the crime of contempt of Congress. But President Bush has told Congress that he will direct the Attorney General not to prosecute members of the administration, at least in some instances, mm-hmm. Who Congress holds in contempt, which creates an extraordinary historical impasse in which the judgment of Congress might be that a witness is required to turn over information. The president believes that witness is not required to turn over information. The way that would normally get resolved is a criminal prosecution brought by the Department of Justice, and a court, a referee, a third party, would decide whether or not the individual had actually committed contempt by deciding whether he was right to assert the privilege. But if the U.S. attorney will not prosecute, there's no way for the matter to get before a court, and there's no way for a court to have the ability to decide whether the contempt citation is lawful. So by, again, asserting a very aggressive authority to block congressional investigation, not only by claiming executive privilege, but now by saying that he will not allow prosecution of members of the executive branch, he not only protects them from prosecution, he even insulates them from having a court decide whether they were right or within their lawful authority to claim executive privilege. And this is really an unprecedented situation.
We're talking about NSA surveillance program, the changes that were made when the president signed new legislation on Sunday. Our guest is Jeffrey Stone, Harry Calvin Jr., Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. And we will continue to take your calls, talk with Professor Stone in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, glad to have you along with us today as we continue talking with Professor Jeffrey Stone of the University of Chicago Law School. Thanks to Carol for her question, and on to Tony in Boulder Junction. Tony, what's on your mind?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to know who appoints the members of the FISA court, and are they subject to senatorial confirmation? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Tony.
I believe it is the Chief Justice of the United States who appoints the members of the FISA court, and I do not believe they are subject to confirmation, given the fact that they've already been confirmed in their appointments to the federal courts initially. So I think that's how it's done. And the theory is that the Chief Justice is supposed to do so in a way that is reasonably neutral in terms of the background and ideology of the judges.
Lance in Antioch, Illinois, let's get you into the conversation. Go ahead.
How you doing? I find the comments to be hypocritical and hyperbole. I mean, all the things you're accusing George Bush might do, I mean, you don't have any specific examples that he's actually committed these crimes, the Democrats have already done. A classic example of this was when Newt Gingrich's cell phone conversation was recorded, and then it was reprinted in the New York Times and then replayed all over the network television stations. And then the Democrats in Congress, they defended this action, and the New York Times defended the action. The people who actually did the recording, they found out, were set up by Congressman McDermott in Florida. He's still in the United States House of Representatives. Nothing has been done about it. These people got a little bit of a fine, and everybody went on their own way. I wonder what the professor said about this 10 years ago when it happened.
Well, first of all, there is a lawsuit pending about the matter. It's not as if nothing has happened. And the lawsuit is continuing to go on between the two congressmen to adjudicate whether, in fact, there was any illegality. So the matter is in the courts and being litigated, and that's exactly what should happen to it with it. The interception of the phone call and the taping of the phone call was clearly not lawful, and the people who did it, in fact, were received a penalty under the law. The question as to whether the congressman who received the information was complicit, I've never heard before as an allegation, and I don't think there's any basis for it. And so the reality here is that that was an unlawful interception of a phone call, and it was appropriate for the individuals who taped it to be punished, and that's what happened. That's exactly what's not happened in this situation.
Lance, thank you very much for raising the point. And on to Rich in Sullivan. Rich, what can we do for you?
Thanks. My question to your guest is this. Does this new law then authorize wiretapping or eavesdropping or whatever you want to call it on all U.S. military personnel, members of the diplomatic corps, members of the American business community, who, if in their conversations, express any serious doubts or misgivings about policy or conduct, are they then also covered, particularly the military, additionally under this law? I know the military has control over communications, but I see this as just sort of a wide open kind of conspiracy to squelch dissent in the broadest sense.
Well, assuming that we're talking about individuals, as I assume your question does, who are overseas, then the only other limitation in the statute on the government's ability to engage in electronic surveillance of their email and telephone conversations is that the government is engaged in a foreign intelligence investigation, and that's an extremely plastic term. So certainly the statute is not meant to authorize the executive to intercept the email communications or engage in wiretapping of Americans overseas simply because they criticize the government. That would not be, nobody would interpret the statute in good faith to mean that that's a foreign intelligence investigation. A foreign intelligence investigation is at least understood in very general terms to involve an individual who is, in fact, working in some serious way to harm the interests of the United States. And I rather doubt that if a court of law ever had a chance to examine the application of this power in a setting in which the only justification for targeting a person was that he had criticized the administration, that they would find that that was legitimate foreign intelligence investigation. But the key thing to remember is because there's no need for a warrant, there's not ever going to be an opportunity for a court to know how foreign intelligence investigation is being interpreted by the executive branch. That's the problem, is it eliminates all of the ordinary checks and balances in the application of the process. The reason the Fourth Amendment insists upon warrants is because it does not trust the executive branch independently to decide whom to search, whom not to search, when to search, when not to search. It insists that there be a neutral and detached party that reviews that decision. And that's the fundamental defect of this law. It takes FISA out of the picture, which is what Congress had done in 1978, was to put FISA in the picture. It takes FISA out of the picture, and it lets the executive branch interpret reasonably believed to be outside the United States. What is a foreign intelligence investigation? All of those things now become essentially part of a black box, and there's no way for anyone outside the administration to really get a handle on what that, how that's being interpreted.
The legislation is for 6 months only?
Correct. The legislation was enacted in 6 months. This was the compromise. The president took the view that without this authority, he would not be able to protect the nation, although, of course, he didn't have this authority at any point in time since 9/11 till today, or indeed no president has ever had this authority since 1978. But suddenly there was an emergency, according to the president, that Congress had to act, and the compromise they reached was that Congress would authorize the legislation, but it would be limited to 6 months. And within 6 months, it either expires or it would have to be renewed. So there'll be an opportunity, at least in theory, for a further debate on the question 6 months from now.
And in a letter that Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, wrote to the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and to the intelligence chairman, many provisions of this legislation are unacceptable. And although the bill has a 6 month sunset clause, I do not believe the American people will want to wait that long before corrective action is taken. Do you see corrective action being taken?
No, because corrective action would require a new law to be enacted. And that would require either the president's signature or a two-thirds approval to override a veto, neither of which is going to happen. So the idea that Congress can act within the six-month period to change this law means it would have to pass a new law, and that's not going to happen over the president's veto, and the president would certainly veto it. So, no, that's just either foolish or hypocritical. The truth is it will have to wait 6 months. And we know now what will happen. In 6 months from now, what will happen is the administration will say, thanks to this power, we have been able to prevent terrorist attacks on the United States that we would not otherwise have been able to prevent. We can't tell you what they are. We can't tell you anything about them. But if you change this law, you're going to put the United States at risk, and it'll be on your head. And, you know, that's exactly how we got in Iraq. It's exactly how we got this legislation. And it's what's going to happen 6 months from now.
Back to the phones to Jay in Amherst next. Hi, Jay.
Oh, hi. Thanks. Is it true, is my understanding right that the satellites through which all our communications pass are outside the U.S. since they are above or beyond our borders and therefore subject to the info gathering for anything passing through?
That's a good question. I don't know the technical answer to that. They certainly are outside the United States. I don't think they're affected by this legislation because anything that goes through the satellites ultimately has to come back down through a land-based data system, and that's where the telecom companies come in. So it's not at the satellite level that the interceptions take place. It's at the telecom land-based level. But in any event, the fact that the satellites are out above the United States, I don't think has anything to do with the application of the statute. It's an interesting question, though.
Jay, thank you so much for posing the question. On to Wayne next in Holman. Wayne, what can we do for you?
Good morning to both you gentlemen. I'm learning a lot here. I'm a conservative Republican, so I thank Public Radio for letting me on. A quick question to the professor. As I understand it, President Carter and Clinton worked under a program called the Echelon Program, and from what I understand, that was probably one of the more intrusive civil liberty violations as far as personal conversations, but this was done under the auspices of two Democrat presidents. Would the guest care to comment on that? And is it true that the program was in fact initiated and used illegally by Carter and Clinton? Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
I don't know the details of the Echelon program. My understanding of it is simply that it was done in compliance with FISA and federal law, but I don't know enough about the details of it to comment.
Thanks very much, Wayne. We appreciate hearing from you. And Mitch, let's give you a chance in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. I think this is just one more step of President Bush into being the Emperor of the United States. He's kind of just overthrow the country. Especially since he's trying to create a government that's offshore, and then he wants to bring it back to this country, which he'll overturn the Constitution. And if everything he does offshore isn't compliant with the Constitution, so what's the sense of him even having an oath of office?
That's a very interesting take. Certainly, one of the strategies that the administration has used during the war on terrorism is to use the basic principle that what the United States does outside the four corners of the United States is not subject to the same rules and limitations as what it does on American soil. And so we know that Guantanamo Bay was constructed where it was by the administration specifically and expressly for the purpose of having it outside American soil so that they would be free to do whatever they wanted to do without the prisoners being able to get habeas corpus relief. And so that was a decision to move offshore this camp rather than to put it within the domestic United States in order to insulate the administration from review. Now, it turned out that the Supreme Court held that the then habeas corpus statute reached Guantanamo Bay, which led to further legislation and so on. But the idea of we can do things overseas that we can't do in the United States is generally a principle that courts have recognized, but until this administration has not been exploited as aggressively as it has now. And it has raised serious questions that haven't been raised previously about the extent to which federal legislation and the Constitution need to be able to reach activities of the government outside the land mass of the United States, because this principle does allow the government to do things that the government shouldn't be doing. And the torture is a good example of that. Secret prisons is an example of that. These are all things which, if done within the United States, would undoubtedly be unlawful. But with the government's claim is, since we're not doing it here, we are basically free to do whatever we want. And so that's kind of a new question that the tactics of this administration have raised, and I think that over the next decade or so, it's a question that both the Congress and the courts are going to have to wrestle with as to how much the ordinary rules that govern the conduct of our executive branch have to be extended from within the United States to outside the United States. And given the nature of technology and communication and globalization, it may be this is inevitable, that the rules have to be broadened to reach the activities of the government wherever they take place.
We're talking about the Protect America Act, which was signed into law by President Bush on Sunday, allowing the United States National Security Agency to intercept telephone conversations, email, and other communications between foreigners that are routed through American equipment. Should a U.S. resident become a target of such an investigation, court approval apparently still will be required. Our guest is Jeffrey Stone, who is a Harry Kelvin Jr. Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. Mitch, thank you very much for posing the question. On to Ken in Albany. Hi, Ken.
The question I have is regarding Senator Feingold's call for censure and what exactly that is compared, the censure of President Bush compared to impeachment.
I need to stop you there because we've got about a minute for this answer.
Well, impeachment is the first step in the removal of the president from office. Under the Constitution, the House of Representatives can impeach the president, which means essentially it's an indictment. And then the Senate tries the president to determine whether he is guilty of a high crime misdemeanor, and if the Senate finds that he is guilty, then he's removed from office. Censure is a device which the Senate and the House have both at times used, usually with their own members, as a way of criticizing them publicly, chastising them publicly, but it has no it has no actual impact upon the ability of the person to remain in office. It's essentially saying, we officially reprimand you for your conduct.
Thank you very much, Ken, for your comment and question. And Professor Stone, it's been a pleasure to have you. It's been very enlightening.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jeffrey Stone is the Harry Calvin Jr. Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. His most recent books are Top Secret, When Our Government Keeps Us in the Dark, published this year by Roman and Littlefield, and War and Liberty, An American Dilemma, published this year also by W.W. Norton. And his previous book, Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism, received the Robert F. Kennedy Book Award for 2005. We thank him for being with us, Professor Jeffrey Stone. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.